call this meeting of this remote hearing of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. It is Tuesday, April 5th, 2022, and this meeting is being held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which allows us to hold this remotely. We will start with the roll. Michaela, go ahead.
Griffin?
Present.
Smaller?
Present.
Scott?
Present.
Feist?
Present.
Frazier?
Present.
Grossel?
Present.
Kerr? Representative Herr. Collins.
Present.
Johnson.
Present.
Liebling.
Present.
Long.
Present.
Mortensen.
Present.
Novotny.
Present.
Barr.
Present.
Robbins.
Present.
Bang. Representative Bang. Zhang?
Present.
All right, a quorum is present. The next item on the agenda is the minutes. Let's see. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of March 31st, 2022?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hollins moves the minutes of March 31st, 2022. Any discussion to the minutes? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right, the minutes are approved. So first on our agenda today, we have Representative Nelson here with us. There was a catch that there's a provision in this bill that we need to vet here in judiciary and civil law. So I will move House File 4125. I believe we're just laying this over. Is that correct, Representative Nelson? It's like you were on mute.
Yeah, I'm just trying to unmute, and I just closed my. Anyway, yes, that's correct. We just need to lay this over.
Okay. So I will move House File 4125 be laid. Move the bill in front of us. We're just going to be laying it over. Particularly, we are just looking at Article 2, Sections 1 and 2, which are within the jurisdiction of this committee. With that, Representative Nelson, please tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill is the governor's supplemental budget bill for the state government finance division. And like the chair said, there's just two provisions in this bill that touch on Chapter 13. And they're basically simple cleanup provisions. The Article 2, Section 1, which in the bill is on page 10.14, and it's a provision that updates and clarifies the language related to the rights of individuals to contest the accuracy and completeness of data about them that is held by a government entity. Among the changes of the new requirement, the data subjects be provided a notice of their right to appeal if a contest is denied, and a deadline for submitting an appeal, and the options for the commissioner to deny the appeal on its face. The other is the section two of that is the opinions when required. It eliminates a required fee that otherwise would be charged a person when they ask for an advisory opinion from the commissioner of the administration on the questions related to the state's open meeting laws. This section also extends a deadline for the commissioner to issue an opinion and modifies the requirements for providing a notice if an opinion is not to be heard. And that's all it does, Madam Chair.
All right. And thank you for maybe the first time ever that someone just talked about the provisions that are before us in this committee. So thank you, Representative Nelson. I know we got to get you back to your committee. Any questions or discussion to the bill? Representative Scott.
Thank you for pausing so I could get my hand up. My brain is just now engaging. I'm just wondering, we have someone here from the Data Practices Office. Ms. Moxley Goldsmith is here. I'm just wondering if she would want to comment on these provisions and kind of the genesis of them.
Sure. Ms. Moxley-Goldsmith, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your response.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Taya Moxley-Goldsmith. I'm the Director of the Data Practices Office at the Minnesota Department of Administration. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and thank you, Representative Scott, for calling me out here. I do have some prepared comments, and I can walk through the bill a little bit and then be available for questions if you have any. So the Data Practices Office, as most of you know, is a statewide resource on data practices and the open meeting law for members of the public and government. And the two sections in House File 4125 that are before this committee are essentially operational updates to the provisions that govern some of the work that the Data Practices Office does. And it can take you through the language just briefly as Representative Nelson summarized. The first section, Article 2, just clarifies the data challenge appeal provisions in Section 13.04 of the Data Practices Act. Data subjects have the right to challenge the accuracy and completeness of data that government entities maintain about them, and then they have the right to appeal the government's determination to the commissioner, and the Data Practices Office administers the appeals for the commissioner. The proposed language moves existing requirements from the administrative rules into the statute so that it's clear for both parties, the data subject and the government. That includes the government providing notice to the individual of the right to appeal and the need for the data subject to appeal to the commissioner within 60 days. So again, these are already existing requirements. We're just pulling them from the rules into the statute so it's clearer for both parties. It's all in one place. The language also clarifies the ability of the commissioner to dismiss appeals that do not meet the threshold requirements without first offering informal resolution. And the added language would limit the commissioner's authority to dismiss to three situations. One is when the data are not about the individual challenging the accuracy or completeness of data. The right to challenge, a person does not have the right to challenge the accuracy and completeness of data about someone else, and they don't have the right to challenge the accuracy and completeness of data that is about something like a process or a procedure. So that just clarifies that the commissioner can dismiss in that circumstance. The second one is when an appeal is not timely. So this would be, for instance, if it was outside that 60 days after the notice. And then the third one is when an appeal involves evidence previously presented in a court proceeding where the data subject is a party or was a party. A certain number of these data challenge appeals come from folks that are incarcerated or part of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, and what they are trying to do, and they're using this process to try to challenge some of that underlying evidence. And the data challenge appeal process is not meant to be another opportunity, basically, to relitigate criminal trials. And the commissioner is not in a position to invalidate evidence that's already come before a judge or a jury. So that's what that provision is about. And the ability to dismiss in these three circumstances is still permissive. So even if an appeal was outside the time limit, the commissioner could still go forward if the circumstances warranted it. And then there's just some reorganizing and renumbering for clarity, you know, breaking up a larger paragraph again, just to make it clear both to data subjects and government what their responsibilities are. So that's section one. Briefly, Section 2 addresses the Commissioners of Administration's authority to issue non-binding advisory opinions on Section 13.072. And currently, there's not a fee to request a data practices advisory opinion, but there is a $200 fee to request an open meeting law advisory opinion. And the bill's language removes that $200 fee. I mean, part of it, to Representative Scott's question, part of the reason for that is we just don't think there should be a monetary barrier for people simply to ask for an opinion. And it is also just administratively inefficient to process and handle those checks. So that's another reason. The bill also updates the time to issue an opinion. As Representative Nelson mentioned, currently it says opinions must be issued in 20 days or plus 30 days for good cause. And this just updates that to 50 calendar days total. And then it codifies the mailbox rule for folks that do not or cannot use email. The language just confirms that we can meet our statutory deadlines when we put the notice in the mail. And so that just codifies current practice. So that's a summary of the two sections. We solicited feedback from various stakeholders, including Minkoji and Mr. Neumeister, the Minnesota Newspapers Association, government stakeholders like League of Minnesota Cities and MICA, the School Boards Association, and the Office of Administrative Hearings. And any feedback that we received, we incorporated into the language that you have before you today. So thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning, and I'm happy to take any other questions you may have.
All right, thank you. Any questions, Representative Scott?
No, Madam Chair, and thank you for allowing me to have her explain in detail what this bill does. And I think it's hopefully it was helpful to members to kind of learn what existing law is and as juxtaposed to what this bill is trying to do. I think these provisions make a lot of sense. And, you know, perhaps in a future year, we'll take a whack at that administrative law judge filing fee of $1,000 too, that prohibits a lot of people from filing when they have a grievance in this realm. So thank you, Ms. Moxley Goldsmith, for that. Thanks for the work that you did to get all the stakeholders involved. And I support these provisions. Thank you, Representative Nelson. I'm assuming, Madam Chair, that this is paid for. The changes where they're not going to be charging the $200 anymore. I'm assuming that's all in Representative Nelson's budget. It doesn't affect ours, obviously. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. And I apologize, Ms. Moxley Goldsmith. When you signed up to testify, we just assumed everyone signing up to testify got put on the list for the the omnibus bill. So glad that you could be with us this morning. Representative Nelson, any response or closing comments?
No, Madam Chair, thank you. And the only question I have would be if Ms. Moxley Goldsmith can send me that background information. And to Representative Scott, yes, it is being paid for as part of my budget omnibus bill. This language will be in the omnibus bill.
All right. Let's see. No other hands up. And with that, the bill is laid over. Representative Nelson, you can go present your omnibus in your committee. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for the time and thank you for making it quick and simple. Have a good day.
Yep, thank you. All right, members, now we can focus on our bill. We're not gonna take any formal action today. We're gonna do a walkthrough with nonpartisan staff. And then we've got a long list of testifiers to testify on the omnibus bill. And so with that, I'm not sure, John or Ben, which one of you wants to start, but if you can introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead and walk us through the DE amendment.
Madam Chair, John Walls, House Fiscal Staff. May I share screen?
Yes, please.
Madam Chair, I will begin. This spreadsheet is done to the DE amendment, and I will begin at the top for the Supreme Court. You'll find throughout this DE amendment that, for the most part, it mirrors the governor's budget requests and with a few additions. And so beginning at the Supreme Court, the governor requested $2.3 million ongoing to maintain core operations. This is included in the DE, as well as $4.3 million ongoing for civil legal services salary increases, $7.4 million for civil legal services COVID response, and $1.75 million ongoing for cybersecurity. To those requests, the DE amendment adds $47 million, $47.8 million, and $58.5 million ongoing for increased services through civil legal services, which brings us down to the Court of Appeals, a governor's request of $621,000 a year to maintain operations is also included. Moving down to the district courts, a request for $14.8 million to maintain operations is included in the DE, as well as $200,000 per year in fiscal years 24 and 25. This is to add funding for a one-time increase that was passed last year for increased interpreter pay. On line 26, a governor's request for mandating psychological services at just shy of $2 million a year is also included. Moving to the guardian ad litem board, a $909,000 annual increase to maintain operations is included. Under the Board of Public Defense, we have a request for electronic file storage and remote hearing access. That's $627,000 in the current fiscal year, and that is on a one-time basis. We have a request for salary equity at $1 million, $1.1 million in 22 and $2.266 million ongoing. That is also included. And the DE amendment provides an additional amount of $50 million per year ongoing to increase services at the Board of Public Defense. Moving down to the Human Rights Commission, there were six initiatives through the governor's budget that were all included through this bill. They encompass about 17 new positions at the board. First is $492,000 for improved caseload processing, $388,000 for bias and discrimination data gathering and reporting, $1.185 million for bias response community equity outreach, $228,000 for equity inclusion strategic compliance. There is a one-time request of $250,000 for an equity inclusion data consultant, and $383,000 a year to prohibit rental discrimination. Madam Chair, that moves us down to the additional bills that were added that were member requests. And the first is on line 63, House File 3135 is establishing the Appellate Council for Parents Board. That is $699,000 in the first year and $1.8 million in ongoing expenses. On line 64, House File 3920 is included. This is to no longer charge for uncertified copies through the court system. There's a loss of revenue of $362,000 this year and $395,000 per year ongoing. Moving down to line 65, we've included House File 3322, and this is to transfer some dollars that would ordinarily flow to the general fund from a fee, and it diverts those to a special revenue fund where it pays for an increase to the Family Resiliency Partnership. That is a $675,000 loss to the general fund to increase the funding for the Resiliency Partnership. And Madam Chair, on the bottom line 73, you can find the total spending, general fund spending for this bill. We meet our targets at $140 million a year in increased spending for the current biennium and $300 million ongoing. And Madam Chair, that completes the walk through the spreadsheet.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Walls. And I will, I'll just note that the governor's request reflects the court's request. I know it's a little bit interesting with us being the only only ones funding a third branch of government. So that's the only thing I want to note for the record, that the governor's request does reflect the court's request. Representative Scott, questions for Mr. Walls.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Walls, for the walkthrough. I wish on these spreadsheets we could get always, you know, what the previous biennium's funding was so that we could see the increase. Do you happen to have, Mr. Walls, both a dollar and percentage increase over what we did last year?
Mr. Walls.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I do have last year's numbers in front of me. If you have a question relating to a specific agency, I don't have the percentage increases, but I could provide those to you in the future.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That would be helpful, I think, for the committee to see kind of the comparison from last year to this year, kind of a grand total and then a percentage. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. With that, we will, they'll still be around if there are more questions. I want to make sure we get through the presentations and the walkthrough with everybody else, and then we'll have time for questions for all of the presenters and for nonpartisan staff. But next, we're going to move to Ben Johnson from House Research, so he can walk through the other provisions. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, it's Ben Johnson from House Research. I'm going to talk about Article 2 very briefly. The walkthrough of the spreadsheet covered all of the appropriations that are in Article 1. Mr. Walls also touched on the provisions that are in Article 2. Article 2 has four sections. The first section is the policy language that establishes the State Board of Appellate Counsel for Parents, which is designed to create and administer a statewide independent appellate counsel program to represent indigent parents on appeal in juvenile protection matters. Sections 2 and 4 are from House File 3322, but have been amended. These are the sections that increase the portion of the filing fee in a dissolution case and the portion of the marriage license fee that is appropriated to the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development for the Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership under Section 116L.96. That increase is $15 for both of those fees. The amount transmitted to the general fund is reduced by $15, so the total fee charged to individuals does not change. Section 3 is the provision that eliminates the fee that the judicial branch was required to charge for providing uncertified copies of a document from a civil or criminal proceeding. The elimination would apply to the uncertified documents provided through an online portal. Madam Chair, those are the four sections in Article 2, and that completes the walkthrough.
All right, thank you. And obviously, since we had the civil law data omnibus, we have not quite as hefty of a bill before us today. Next, we're going to move to a presentation from the courts. We have Jeff Shorba here from the Minnesota Judicial Branch. Mr. Shorba, please introduce yourself. And then I believe, not sure if you're screen sharing, but I know you've got some materials for us. So please go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jeff Shorba, and I'm the State Court Administrator for the Minnesota Judicial Branch, and I believe Andy is going to share my screen here in a minute. We just wanted to talk briefly about our supplemental budget request. The request focuses on four key priorities. Those include helping address our workforce challenges and ensuring we can continue to attract and retain qualified judicial officers and staff, addressing the rising cost of providing statutorily and constitutionally mandated services, protecting our courts from cybersecurity attacks, and finally, as was mentioned in the walkthrough, trying to make permanent a temporary increase to court interpreter pay. And I'll just briefly touch on these four priorities. Our highest priority this session is addressing what we see as a significant workforce challenge facing our organization. I talked with you a little bit about this when I was before the committee on February 3rd, but the chart on the screen here just shows an example of the share of employees who have left employment with the judicial branch in each of the past 4 years. And that share of departing employees has increased by 42% since 2018. Not only are we posting more job openings, but we're receiving fewer and fewer applications for each open position. Back in 2019, we had an average of 48 applicants for each open position in the branch. Last year, we were down to 19 applicants for each open position. And we understand that the courts are far from the only employer facing workforce challenges at this unique time in history. Virtually every public and private employer in the country is facing similar challenges. But the key point I want to emphasize with the committee is that the Minnesota Judicial Branch has fallen behind our public sector peers in terms of compensation, which puts us at a particular disadvantage when it comes to competing for talent and attracting attorneys and experienced staff to come work in our state court system. During my last visit to the committee, I showed you this chart that highlights how our court employees have fallen behind their public sector peers in recent years. It shows a hypothetical salary progression of two employees hired at the same time at the same rate of pay in both the judicial and executive branches. And while both employees earn 2.5% merit increases in their first 3 years, the executive branch also offered across the board salary increases on top of the merit increases. So in just 3 years, the judicial branch employee is earning 6.4% less than the executive branch counterpart who was hired at the same wage. This is just one example of how our compensation structure has fallen behind other public sector organizations And as soon as I've finished, you'll be hearing more from the Minnesota District Judges Association about how our judge salaries are similarly falling behind public sector attorneys. So the judicial branch strives to ensure adequate compensation for its judges and staff. However, we're not going to be able to address this disparity without additional support from the legislature. So during the last budget session, the judicial branch requested and the legislature approved salary increases for just 1 year of the biennium. And we are extremely grateful for that 2.5%. But now that the budget situation has improved, we are back asking for funding to provide compensation increases in the second year of the biennium as well. And given the issues I just highlighted for you, we are seeking funding to increase judge salaries by 6% in fiscal year 23 and create an employee compensation increase pool of similarly 6% in fiscal year 23. So we hope and we are very grateful for the recommendation of the governor and of Chair Becker Finn to fund this increase. The next part of our budget request relates to the rising cost of providing psychological exams in criminal and civil commitment cases. We are responsible for the cost of providing those exams under Rule 20 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure and under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 253B. Which includes commitments of persons who are mentally ill and dangerous, persons with sexual psychopathic personalities, and sexually dangerous persons. We are experiencing significant increases in the court-related costs. That cost grew by 32% from fiscal year 2019 to 2021, and it's primarily due to an increase in civil commitment examinations. Those examinations increased by 51% during that same time period. So we are estimating that we are facing a deficit of $1.9 million per year to meet those rising costs for psych exams. So we're asking the legislature to provide us with that additional funding so we can continue to meet those statutory and constitutional obligations. The third part of our request seeks $1.75 million per year in funding for the branch's cybersecurity program. We did have this in our budget request last biennium, but it was not funded. We launched our cybersecurity program in 2017, and it's really become a critical part of our court operations. As we have embraced an all-electronic case record and shifted more and more of our court hearings and our backroom court operations to the online world, cybersecurity has really become a paramount concern for our court system. Our program not only works to ensure the reliability of court operations and services, but also to safeguard the private and non-public data stored by our courts. So this funding would allow us to enhance our security and risk management program, mitigate the risk of data breaches, data corruption, system outages, et cetera. So this request would address necessary training, hardware, and software needs that we have right now to maintain our program. Finally, the last priority relates to an appropriation you made last year. You appropriated one time $200,000 in fiscal year 2022 and 2023 to increase the pay for contract court interpreters. The judicial branch has adjusted those payment rates for our contract interpreters commensurate with the $200,000 annual appropriation, but we would like to make this permanent. If this funding is not provided, we'll have to revert back to the previous levels once the funding expires. So we're asking for $200,000 annual appropriation to our base budget. To close out my presentation, here's a detailed look at the supplemental funding we're requesting. In response to Representative Scott's question, this funding increase represents a 2.79% increase to our base budget. So we think, given our current financial situation, that's a reasonable request. And again, I want to thank the governor and the chair for including this in their supplemental recommendations. I'm happy to answer questions, and I know Judge Conroy is also here to talk about judge requests. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you. I do see we do have a question. I'm assuming it's for you, Mr. Shorba, Vice Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Shorba. I have a question. I was curious about the increase for staff and judges I can certainly understand the workforce shortage when it comes to staff. I do frequently, when it comes to judges, I follow who the Judicial Selection Committee is recommending for interviews. And I can tell that you're getting a lot of very qualified, great candidates for judges. I guess my question for you is, for that 6% ask, do you always request the same increase for staff as you do for judges? Is that just like the general practice? Or do you ever make different requests depending on whether it's for staff or for judges?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Mueller. That's a great question. I'm sure Judge Conroy has something to say about it as well. Our tradition has been not to ask more for judges than we ask for staff. We have varied very infrequently from that because of sort of equity issues. We don't want to play one side against the other. I'm sure that she can talk a little bit more about what we're seeing in terms of applicants for judges that are coming forward, but yes, you're correct. Traditionally, our ask has been the same for both. Thank you.
All right. Any follow-up, Vice Chair Mueller? Okay, great. Now we'll move on to testimony from Judge Conroy. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
May it please the chair and members of the committee. My name is Lois Conroy. I'm a trial court judge in the 4th Judicial District and president of the Minnesota District Judges Association. MDJA is a trade organization that represents nearly all of the active and retired judges across the entire state of Minnesota. I am here today for two purposes. One, to thank you for including us in your budget bill and specifically the 6% for judges and staff. And I am very grateful for you recognizing, and Chair, you said this at the beginning of your remarks, recognizing that you're funding the third branch of government. So thank you for those remarks. I want to share my screen for a moment to talk a little bit about the challenges. One moment. The challenges that the judiciary is facing. I want to acknowledge that by placing the judiciary into your budget and funding our request, that you are helping us accomplish some important priorities. And Vice Chair, I want to address in part the question that you asked earlier, that this is an important part of supporting staff and judge compensation. The funding is important for attracting and retaining a diverse workforce. And let me just segue to the issue about the Judicial Selection Commission. We have actively sought out candidates to apply for judgeships. The last four persons that I have gone to recruit from private practice, because we don't have enough private practitioners coming to the bench, cited two main reasons, all four of them. They had varied reasons why they would not apply. But the two factors that the four lawyers that I attempted to recruit from civil practice to come to the bench, the two factors they had in common is, one, they didn't want to take a pay decrease, and second, they didn't want to increase their workload. And so we have an obligation to attract people to the bench, not who are just qualified, but also bring diversity of experience to the bench. That includes both criminal and civil experience. Also, as you may know, Minnesota remains one of the top producing courts in terms of quality in the country. Supporting pay that keeps us in the competitive corridor is really important in keeping a high quality court to serve the citizens of this great state. I also want to turn my attention to how judge salaries compare to other public sector salaries. As you may know, district court judges are frequently earning less than county prosecutors, public attorneys that are appearing in front of them. There was a report done in 2020 that said that metropolitan county attorneys are earning between 8 and 23% more than district court judges. In some counties, even the assistant county attorneys are earning more than judges. This segues back to how important your budget is in funding the judiciary. It sends a really important message that the third branch of government is valued. And I am concerned about our ability to retain judges. In 2001, 16 judges left the judicial branch. Here we are in April of 2022, and we've already had the same number leave just this year. We're on track to exceed our number from last year. I think this is in part due to the challenges we faced in the judiciary, and I want you to know that the judicial branch, and in particularly judges and staff, have really embarked upon innovation in the judiciary. We have created virtual courtrooms in every courthouse across the state. We are hearing legal arguments, taking witness testimony, receiving exhibits into evidence, and we are all doing this via virtual courtrooms and at the same time creating access for the public. And so I want to say that we have met the challenges of this pandemic environment. I've never seen judges work as hard as they are working today, and want to thank all of you for your support in funding the third branch of government. And so I just want to end here. I know your time is short today, but Madam Chair, members of the committee, on behalf of all of my colleagues, thank you so much for your support of the judiciary.
All right. It looks like we do have a couple member questions. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question for Judge Conroy. Can you tell me a couple of questions. Can you tell me what the starting salary is for a judge?
Judge Conroy.
That varies by each level. So there's a compensation set for district court judges, appellate judges, and Supreme Court judges. And I can send you the new figures for 2021. And I believe you had a second question that.
Yeah, and the second question is, what's the starting salary for a law clerk for a judge?
Go ahead, Judge Conroy.
Not enough. And in fact, one of the conversations amongst our judicial council for the past several months is, how do we create greater incentives to attract law clerks to come to the judiciary, but also how do we build in incentives? One of the conversations that we've had at Judicial Council is there a way to give a higher level of compensation? So while judges will receive, if funded, 6%, it is our hope that the 6% is a pool of money, meaning there may be certain areas within the judiciary in which, for example, law clerks who are so very hardworking, and lawyers, as you know, can they be compensated more than that in order to get them into the competitive corridor? Law clerks are leaving at an unprecedented rate right now, which I think you may be aware of, thus your question, and yeah. We need to compensate them better. And what you're hearing from the Minnesota District Judges Association is that our support for these salaries aren't just for our members, but are for staff as well.
Quick,
go ahead, Representative Frazier.
That's correct. Thank you. I know you said that it's at different levels in terms of the starting salaries for the judges, but do you off the top of your head know, most of our judges start at the district court level, do you off the top of your head know what that starting salary level is for a district court judge?
Judge Conroy.
I will get you those numbers. Because they change each year, I wouldn't want to testify to a particular number, but I'm happy to get you those numbers, Representative Frazier.
That's fair.
Representative and, Frazier.
Yeah, just one last question. For the judicial clerks, I know you said it's not enough, but do you have a number at Judge judicial Henry. Court level?
Our hope is that we can now be in the competitive corridor of other public salaries, that we are not having law clerks leave our chambers, and that we only train them in only for them to leave because they cannot afford between their student loans to remain in the judiciary. And so, once again, I would be happy to get you the precise numbers, but as you know, they change and they vary based on what step our law clerks are on. So it's sort of a complex question, but I'd be happy to get you specific numbers following today's testimony.
All right. Well, I can tell you, I just Googled it on the Minnesota Judicial Branch website, judicial salaries for fiscal year 21. A district court judge starting salary was $165,000 was the starting salary. Mr. Shorba, do you have, I'm guessing somebody has to approve posting these judicial clerk jobs, and you may be able to give us an idea at least of what those postings start at. Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, the law clerk starts at a little over $59,000 a year. And we have a two-tier rate because in the past, most law clerks have only stayed for a year or two. So it goes up in their second year, but they start at 59.
All right. Thank you. And I will note, law clerks have to be attorneys. So often a lot of folks go straight from law school to being law clerks. So those student loans start coming due as well. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm glad to have Judge Conroy with us this morning. I wasn't aware that she was going to be testifying. But one of the things that I wanted to address was the deep dive that our staff did in the downward departures and using the data that the Sentencing Guideline Commission uses. And
Representative Scott, is this relevant to their salaries?
Well,
otherwise, I'm going to get to additional testimony, and we can certainly, you know, if it's something that you want to take up with Judge Conroy, that's fine. But we're going to stick to the our omnibus finance bill today.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're talking about their salaries, and one of the things that judges do is obviously sentence people, and it's very troubling. I think the 4th Judicial District has the highest rate of downward departures for felonies.
Representative Scott, if we have time at the end, we can ask more questions of the judges, but we're going to get to all the testifiers first.
Madam Chair, I would just like to meet with Judge Conroy. Maybe we'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Great. All right. Well, not seeing any other hands up for Mr. Shorba or Judge Conroy. We're going to move on to the next testifier. We have Commissioner Lucero from the Department of Human Rights. So we're going to another area besides the judicial branch of what's covered in our budget. So Commissioner, please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Chair Becker Finn, members of the committee. It's good to be back with all of you today. For the record, my name is Rebecca Lucero, and I'm the commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Joined with me here today is Eric Armakonke, who many of you know, and is always available to help answer any questions about our work. We're pleased to be with you to share our support of the supplemental budget and what is included in the omnibus bill, House File 3920. So as you know, whenever I testify, I always like to take a quick second to provide context for what it means to support the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Funding this state agency, Minnesotans, like for instance, a personal care assistant, a PCA, and a senior living assistant, get support after a resident repeatedly shouted racist epithets and made derogatory comments about the PCA's race, skin, and hair. When the PCA and other employees reported the racial harassment to her supervisor, the supervisor repeatedly denied the PCA's request to work with a different resident and instead fired her. The PCA said, "I was blatantly ignored when I raised concerns about being racially harassed. I was ignored again when I was fired because of my race. All I wanted was my job back and nobody cared at all." And she met with staff at the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. An investigator conducted a thorough, independent investigation and determined that there was probable cause that discrimination existed as outlined in the Minnesota Human Rights Act. As the state civil rights enforcement agency, The staff at the Minnesota Department of Human Rights work hard every day on behalf of Minnesotans. We are a small agency with a big mission. And this is just one of many examples of some of the work we do each day and why our department's budget is so critical for Minnesotans. So for the specifics of House File 3920, there are just a few specifics I'd like to highlight. First, thank you for funding our investigator capacity increase. This investment allows us to hire additional investigators to decrease caseloads per investigator. It makes sure our investigations can be conducted as effectively and efficiently as possible. It may also be helpful to note that, like every industry right now, our investigators are also choosing to leave and find other great experiences elsewhere. Most of the investigators that we have are lawyers, and it takes quite a while to train in investigators and make sure we have staff. And so making sure we have the right capacity, make sure that we can handle the transitions when they occur, and that we can keep up the efficiency and effectiveness in our cases. Second, I am also grateful for the appropriations related to our state contracting work. So our strategic compliance proposal requires that our work make data-driven decisions. This means the team strategically identify where contractors need more oversight and support, and then to provide that additional support. It also means that the team can strategically identify where the contractors are doing the work well, so that those contractors can focus solely on that work and aren't subject to full audits from the Department of Human Rights to make because they don't need that additional support. So the agency needs the staff who can appropriately analyze data for this strategic compliance work, especially as the state's population becomes more racially diverse. Additionally, our one-time proposal to contract with a data technology consultant will allow us to work with an expert to help our department set up those data systems for evaluating compliance with our workforce and equal pay certificates. And lastly, I really want to highlight two important proposals that I'm excited to talk to you about. Ensure that we are better responding to the real concerns that I know everyone has about the bias and hate incidents that are occurring across the state and across the country. This is real community-driven proposals that are responding to these incidents. This is an issue our agency really started zeroing in on at the beginning of the pandemic. You'll remember back then, the FBI warned that it expected a surge in anti-Asian bias and hate incidents. And we did see that quickly play out across the country and unfortunately here in Minnesota too. Now, one of the challenges, though, is that a lot of these anti-Asian incidents are not tracked. Neither are other bias or hate incidents, think anti-Semitic or anti-LGBT incidents. So, of course, hate crimes themselves are tracked by the FBI and here at the state level by the BCA. And, of course, if somebody calls about an incident that is covered by the Minnesota Human Rights Act, we would conduct a thorough independent investigation under the Minnesota Human Rights Act itself. But for many incidents that occur, they are neither criminal or maybe don't get investigated or charged at the criminal level. So they're not tracked as a hate crime, nor are they covered under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. So there is no coordinated, consistent tracking, reporting, analysis, and recommendations on next steps for those bias and hate incidents. So the proposal here gets at exactly this issue to ensure we have the resources needed to work with the community groups that are leading on this work. We want to be in a position to report back to the legislature on what may be effective moving forward. So the first proposal allows us to strengthen our bias and discrimination data gathering. This investment will help us track, analyze, and report on bias and hate incidents, as well as collaborate with community-based groups that do their own collections to make sure that we're sharing this information and determining next best steps. The second proposal allows us to develop an outreach team that would be fully equipped to respond to bias and hate incidents across the state. So this team will have a two-pronged goal. The first is to build long-term partnerships across the state and to provide education and outreach to help curb hate and discrimination from happening. It's really want to make sure that there's a team equipped to provide immediate, culturally relevant response when some sort of act of discrimination or hate occurs. Think about at a synagogue or at a mosque when anything happens there, we want the team to be ready to go in. There's been a lot of powerful grassroots work on bias and hate over the past years. particularly with the rise in anti-Asian hate. So we appreciate the collaboration we've had with community-based organizations and state legislators, and we look forward to continuing these partnerships in the future. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify and speak in strong support of the civil rights components of your supplemental budget. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right, any questions for the commissioner? All right, well, I'm sure at least you or Mr. Armakonki can stick around if there are questions at the end. You do have a lot of other testifiers on the list today. So thank you for your testimony. So next on the list, I have Geetanjali Mittal. If you can unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Geetanjali Mittal, and I'm with the Coalition of Asian American Leaders. As an organizational partner of the Communities Combating Hate Coalition, I'm testifying on behalf of the coalition in support of the bias response and data reporting allocations to NDHR. The Communities Combating Hate Coalition advocates for policy change to make Minnesota safe for all Minnesotans, no exceptions. Thank you, Chair Becker-Fan and committee members, for the inclusion of funding for MDHR anti-bias data collection and community outreach. Hate is on the rise in our country and in Minnesota. Research says one in five Asian American Pacific Islanders, or AAPIs, nationally experienced a hate incident in the past year. Cal survey shared 62% of AAPIs in Minnesota said racism or hate was the biggest issue facing Asian Minnesotans. And 50% respondents said they were impacted by an incident of anti-Asian hate. Many incidents still go unreported. We all know the incidents reported are much lower when compared to the actual incidents of physical and verbal abuse that have happened in public places, stores, and schools. The year 2021 also saw many incidents of hate targeted towards the Asian communities in Minnesota. The Hmong Cultural Center was defaced and spray painted with racist graffiti. In Brooklyn Park, an Asian man's car was vandalized with racial slurs. The hate that started in public places has reached our schools and our children. I speak from my own experience of my six-year-old being told to go back to your country. We would like to thank the Minnesota Department of Human Rights for their support this past year and for instituting the discrimination helpline after efforts made by Cal. But we know that much more needs to be done. Reporting hate incidents is not enough, and it is critical that culturally competent responders are sent to support those who have been impacted by hate. This is why we would also urge funding the trusted community organizations to act as co-responders when instances of hate occur. The Communities Combating Hate Coalition urges you to support the important MDHR anti-bias provisions within the House Judiciary Omnibus Bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Kendall Takashita. If you can introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, and thank you to the Chair, Vice Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Kendall Takashita, and I am a McAllister student and a Capital Pathways intern for the Coalition of Asian American Leaders. I'm also a board member of Minnesota's Japanese American Citizens League. I chose to intern at Cal because of both its dedication to the community and its expertise in advocacy. Throughout my term, I have seen Cal act as a beacon of hope for many people through their events and workshops. I was particularly moved by hearing a Cal leader testify for post-conviction relief at their annual Asian Minnesotans at the Capitol event. On this day, a spouse and mother bravely stood in the Capitol, pleading for legislators to recognize the injustice her family was experiencing. Her husband, a longtime Minnesota resident who came to the U.S. as a refugee child under the U.S.-Vietnamese Humanitarian Resettlement Program, made a mistake at the age of 18, which led to his involvement in the criminal court system. Perplexed by this system, they followed their attorney's advice to plead for a six-month sentence to boot camp. However, he discovered that boot camp was not an option and was forcibly funneled into the immigration system. This family was wronged by the criminal justice system and should have the opportunity to seek justice. House File 833 for post-conviction relief would provide this family and many others with an opportunity to seek justice. I connected personally with this story because during World War II, my family was wrongfully placed in internment camps against their will without any opportunity to seek justice. The impacts and trauma of my family's unjust incarceration span generations. We need to end these injustices from reoccurring, and House File 833 is an important first step toward a more equal justice system. So I would once again like to thank the community members for their due diligence in prioritizing the need of Asian Minnesotans during these difficult times and correcting mistakes in our justice system that will allow individuals to seek relief from a wrongful conviction, regardless of how much time has elapsed. I would ask for the inclusion of post-conviction relief within this bill as the committee continues to work on this bill this week. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Takashi, for your testimony. Moving on, I have Jim Rubenstein. If you can introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jim Rubenstein. I'm now retired, but I was a lawyer engaged in private practice of law in the Twin Cities for over 40 years. I'm also a proud constituent of committee member Jamie Long. And just so you know, I'm the treasurer of his Neighbors for Jamie Long, his campaign organization this year. Now, more importantly for today, I'm also a member of Jewish Community Action, a Minnesota-based organization bringing together Jewish people from diverse traditions and perspectives to promote understanding and take action on social and economic justice issues. Thank you for the opportunity to speak at this hearing. Please include post-conviction relief provisions found in House File 388 in the Judiciary Finance Omnibus Bill. In that way, this bill will expand post-conviction relief options to people involved in immigration removal proceedings. Many people do not realize that a conviction can trigger a deportation order and lead to exile for those who may have had status in the United States for many years and established lives here. The federal government's fluid immigration policies and its changes to laws and regulations often saddle people with a second round of consequences for prior Minnesota conviction that may have been unforeseen or unknown at the time of the conviction. This reminds me of a biblical passage from the Old Testament, Book of Deuteronomy. Many of you people have heard it before, and it goes very simply, justice, justice shall you pursue. Scholars in my tradition ask why the word justice is repeated here. In the context of post-conviction relief, one answer may be that sometimes it is necessary to look twice at whether a justice was done and to take a second look at a prior conviction. Accordingly, in the pursuit of justice, we should be open to, if not eager, to examine a prior conviction under the circumstances of immigration removal proceedings. Please include post-conviction relief within this bill as the committee continues to work on it this week. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. And I understand there'll be an amendment on Thursday to add that provision to the bill. With that, the next on the list, I have Rebecca Chang. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Hello, everyone. Good morning, Chair, Vice Chair, and committee members. My name is Rebecca Chang, and I'm the organizing director of Minnesota 8. Minnesota 8 provides support to Southeast Asian Americans and their loved ones who are impacted by detention and deportation. And I'm here, along with my other colleagues, to strongly urge you to include post-conviction relief within this bill as the committee continues to work on it this week. And I want to ground us as I speak in our shared values of freedom, family, and opportunity as I share my comments today. Many of the individuals who Minnesota 8 works with came to the United States as refugees after the Vietnam War. They arrived as children to this country that was an unfamiliar place with a language they did not know. They and their families often lived in disinvested neighborhoods and experienced discrimination and racial profiling on top of challenges adjusting to a new country. So it is in this context that the individuals who we work with made mistakes. Our federal immigration laws have changed drastically since when these mistakes happened. So many times, these individuals and their lawyers advising them had no idea their actions could lead to future deportation. Our clients have taken responsibility for their actions and years later have successful and fulfilling jobs, have gotten married, and have had U.S. citizen children and grandchildren. For example, last year, you heard from community member Damu Vang speaking about his father and Min Lam speaking about her husband. Both of them shared how important their loved one was to them and the harmful impact that deportation would have on their families. Deportation is a double punishment for community members, especially because individuals would be deported to a country where they don't know the language and where they have no family or friends at all. And I advocate for you to think about values of redemption and humanity for all, and reiterate to please include post-conviction relief within the judiciary omnibus bill so these individuals have an opportunity to contest faulty convictions through post-conviction relief and remain with their families. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Shambri Lesniak. I apologize if I got your name wrong. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Shambri Lesniak, and I am an official court reporter with the Minnesota Judicial Branch, and I am also a union steward. I am here on behalf of Maverick, which is the Minnesota Association of Verbatim Reporters and Captioners, to voice our support for the 6% budget increase for court staff. And I thank you for giving me a brief opportunity to speak this morning. I can tell you firsthand that this 6% increase is absolutely crucial in order to retain current court reporters. Just as a little background, court stenographers are required to graduate from an accredited court reporting school and write 225 words a minute before we're employed with a branch. We are also required to provide our own court reporting equipment, which can cost a new court reporter upwards of $10,000 just to start. Our equipment come with support contracts as well, which have increased over time with inflation. The Minnesota court reporters operate on a step scale. So when I was hired in 2014 by my judge, I was hired at step 1 of 8. And we both thought that this meant in 8 years, I would reach the top of the step scale. However, 7.5 years later, I'm now at step 3 of 11. It's just the past budget increases haven't been enough to fund a step increase for the court reporters. What's happened is we're all moving up at the same rate. And so it's created this lockstep situation. And we're all just kind of stuck waiting for the next step increase. In the long run, I don't really know if I'll have an avenue to reach the top of the pay scale. But I do know that this 6% will fund a step increase for the court reporters for fiscal year 23 and greatly boost morale. Again, I thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Brooke Beskow-Warg. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Brooke Beskow-Warg. I am an attorney and Equal Justice Works Fellow with the Institute to Transform Child Protection. And I am here to briefly testify about the bill to establish an Office of Appellate Counsel for Parents. I want to just start by saying thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, for carrying this bill to establish this office and for including it in your omnibus bill. An Office of Appellate Counsel for Parents is important for protecting the rights of individual parents, keeping families together when it's possible to do so, and reducing racial disparities in the system. It's also a significant step in improving the child welfare system in Minnesota as a whole. So again, I just want to thank you for carrying this important bill, and thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you for your testimony. I also want to direct members, we do have letters that were emailed out and are on our website from the Minnesota Family Resiliency Project, as well as Civil Legal Services, and there are a couple other public testimony posted on there as well. Always good to have the option to have testimony submitted in writing as well. We do not have any more testifiers on the list, but we do have Several folks available for questions, including Dori Rappaport from Legal Aid, Tammy Baker Olson from the Guardian Ad Litem Board, as well as others who have testified. So we can move on if members have questions for any of the testifiers. Or not. All right. Nothing wrong with giving people time to eat breakfast, to go outside. We will have a busy day on Thursday, members. And actually, I'll give one more. If there's anyone on the Zoom that I forgot, please feel free to raise your hand or speak up. We have a long list today. Doesn't look like it. All right, so we'll just speak to the plan for Thursday and remind members. So the amendment deadline will be tomorrow at 10 a.m., our normal amendment deadline time for Thursday's markup of this bill. And then Thursday, we will be meeting in person, hybrid situation in Capitol Room 120. So we're all going to have to get up a little bit earlier and make it to the Capitol if we plan to be in person. I would just ask if there are any members planning to be remote. It does have hybrid capabilities in the room, but if there are any members planning to be remote, just make sure that the committee administrator is aware of that so we can make sure we're all set for Thursday. Members, any questions in general about protocols or anything? Anything else for Thursday? We'll be we made it the whole biennium on Zoom, and we're finally going to be in person. So we'll look forward to seeing everybody. All right. Well, with that, we will wrap up. Thank you to all of our testifiers, and feel free to reach out to testifiers in the meantime if members do have individual questions for them as well. And with that, we are adjourned.